No, you may remember that in the last class, we discussed the four verses in the Bhakti Yoga, 12th chapter, where Lord Krishna gives four levels of evolution in devotional philosophy, devotional life. It's called Bhakti Yoga, the yoga of devotion. If you believe in a God, gradually you must aim at reaching the highest peak of devotional evolution, where you feel that you dwell in God and God dwells in you. I mean, we live in God and the God's permanent residence is our hearts. This is the Mayyeva Manathatsva Mai Buddhim Nivesiya Nivasishasi Mayyeva Atahudhanasamsya. 8th verse. I shall just repeat. Now, this is the highest reach. But there is a way to reach that stage, even for the beginner. So in the 9th verse, Lord Krishna comes down a step. He comes a step down and says that those who have not reached this stage can practice constant remembrance, thinking, contemplation, meditation, and so on the reality of God. It's called Abhyasa Yoga. So, Atha Chittam Samadhadam Nashaknoshi Mayi Sthiram Abhyasa Yogena Tadu Mamichatum Dhananji. This is the 9th verse. This is the second stage. That means, from the highest peak, the Lord comes down to a lower level and gives another option, an alternative. If you cannot, if you feel you are disappointed, well, if you feel that you cannot always think about God, you cannot feel the presence of the Lord in you, or your presence in the Lord, then try to reach this stage through constant practice of remembrance, reading, contemplation, associating our mind with spiritual ideas, whatever means it may be. In the 10th verse, he gives another option. He says, Dabhyasepi asamarthosi matkarma paramo bhava madartham abhikarmani kurvan siddhima vapshasi. Asamartha means incompetent, not capable, unfit, not proficient. These are the meaning. So, if you cannot practice the remembrance of God in your workplace, in the factory, in the office, or when you are working in the kitchen, or when you are interacting with other people, if you can't do that, then do one thing. Whatever you do, look upon that work as my work, means God's work. You find this idea stressed again and again in the writings of Brother Lawrence and also St. Teresa of Avila. As in the last two sessions I referred to this. The synthesis of human effort and God's grace. Free will and predetermination, you may call it. And then in the 11th verse, the teacher comes down to the level of the beginner. I mean those who belong to the kindergarten stage of spiritual evolution. There, Lord Krishna says, don't think about God if you cannot. Don't worry about spiritual ideas if you cannot. Though you should, of course, aim to reach that stage, but if you cannot do that at this stage, you do whatever work you are ordained to do. Any responsibility or duty or work that you have to do, it's not your choice, do that. But then surrender the work and its result mentally to God. Sometimes people make some very, very ridiculous interpretations criticizing Gita. You work hard and you give a check to God, donate to a church or a temple. I mean, because karma phala means the fruit of labor. the result of work. Which means mentally, well, this is yours. This feeling of surrender, which you find Gandhi emphasizes in his Anasakti Yoga, means Gita, the science of selfless, the gospel of selfless action, you find. That is, atha etadapi ashaktosi kartum madhyogamasyadaha sarva karma phalatyagam tadakkuru yathatmavad. 11th verse. Now, in continuation of this discussion, I am coming to another very important topic. The disciple, the teacher, Arjuna, asks an important question. The question is related to two levels of yoga. One, how to start? That suppose you start, if you don't make enough progress, what happens to us? So you find in the sixth chapter, in the 24th verse, Lord Krishna gives a very, very interesting suggestion. Shanai shanai rubaramet buddhya dhrudhi ghritaya atma samstham manak krutva na kinchidapi chintayet. So here he emphasizes that you should be patient. You should slowly, gradually turn the mind from the objects of senses towards the spiritual ideal. Now how do we do it? That's the question. Normally, our senses are by the very nature designed, programmed to look outside towards external objects. When we look at an object with our eyes, mind and eyes come together and creates a visual image, and that image continues to exist in our mind even after we close our eyes, which is called memory. So there are two states of human consciousness where we relive our previous experiences. One is memory, the other is dream. In these two states, we relive, we bring back from a previous experience what we have experienced, the objects that we have noticed. Maybe we may heard a noise, we may listen to a music or a song, we are able to repeat that after several hours. Which means when we repeat the same music or the same word, we are actually reliving the previous experience of hearing it. Of course, their ears are not involved, mind alone is involved. And this happens in memory, this happens in dream also. So we hear many things in our day-to-day life activities. We see many things. We touch many things. So all the five senses of perception and mind constantly come in contact with external objects. And so these five senses bring to the mind, fill the mind with visual experiences, audio experiences, and different types of experiences. And they create a permanent ripple in the mind. They leave a mark, and very often when we try to meditate, the objects we have seen maybe 10 years back. Sometimes if you believe in Vedanta, in previous life also, comes back to the mind. That's why sometimes we remember things, teja vu we call, we go to a place, we get the feeling, well, we have been here sometime, somewhere. But we can't trace, the memory won't go back that way, to those visual experiences, which means the memory comes from another source, previous life. So if we feel, if we experience memory of something without name and form, only as an abstract idea, that experience comes from previous life. If the memory is associated with a name and form, that experience comes from this life. That is the thesis of Shankaracharya. Nama and Rupa. See, if you see an elephant now, tomorrow you may remember the elephant. The name, the elephant, if it has a name and also its form, will come to the mind. But if an abstract idea, without any association with name and form, comes to the mind, well, it mind should have picked up this idea. It comes from another source, the previous life. In fact, Lord Krishna is dealing with these intricate aspects of human life and existence in the coming verses we are going to discuss today. So he says, mind gets naturally distracted towards external objects. Mind is being constantly dragged into different visual, audio objects, different objects by the five senses. So slowly, mind should be brought inward, not forcibly. If you make any attempt to forcibly try to make the mind do something, mind will do just the opposite. As I gave the other day an example, long back, perhaps last year. See, a modern, ultra-modern man, rather, wanted to make fun of an Ayurvedic physician. So, well, he said he was losing hair. Do you have any medicine? So Ayurvedic physician knew this man was trying to mock at him. So he gave him a medicine. You never think of an egg. You should never contemplate on an egg. So now, every moment he was struggling not to contemplate, not to remember an egg, which means every moment he was thinking about an egg. Unless you think of it, you cannot try to avoid thinking about it. So it so happened he went completely bald in course of time. Now what happens if we deliberately try to force the mind to do something, not to do something, mind will naturally do that very thing. But you are struggling to drive the mind away from, mind will go exactly towards that object. So Patanjali Yoga Sutras and also Gita give one prescription for this problem. Don't worry about where the mind goes, but try to feed the mind with spiritual thoughts, spiritual ideas. Well, mind has to take in some visual images, memories, impressions, tendencies, because eyes cannot be kept closed. So eyes will see many objects. Ears will hear many things. Like that, all the five senses of perception. So try to direct these five senses of perception towards spiritually helpful objects. Instead of seeing unpleasant, undesirable things, try to engage the eyes on objects which may be helpful in spiritual life. So that mind will be fed with healthy spiritual food rather. Feed the mind with healthy spiritual food. Otherwise the mind will take poison and will fall sick. Mind has to go somewhere. You can't keep it stagnant. That's why Krishna says in another context, Nahi kasikshanamabhi jadu tishtati akarma krithi. You can never keep inactive, completely free from action, mentally and physically at the same time. If you are inactive, mind will always be active. Mind will be thinking and contemplating, even if you sit in an easy chair. So, here says, Shanai shanai ruparamed buddhya. Slowly we must draw the mind towards spiritually helpful impressions, ideas and objects. That way mind should be strengthened, spiritualized. Now in the sixth chapter, Arjuna puts a very interesting question. After listening to the characteristics of an illumined yogi in the second chapter, and after listening to the fundamental teachings of all the four yogas in the second chapter itself, and after listening to a complete detailed exposition of Karma Yoga in the third chapter, Arjuna naturally puts a very interesting question. Maybe as Shankaracharya in the commentaries, Arjuna Nimitti Kirti. Arjuna is the representative spokesman of the whole humanity. So Lord Krishna is using Arjuna as an instrument. So Arjuna is placed in the position of the spokesman of the whole humanity. So he asked the question. Suppose you work hard, you meditate, we try to do unselfish deed, we contemplate, we make all sincere efforts possible, all possible efforts we make to lead a spiritual life. There are two possibilities. One possibility is that perhaps there is a deviation. We may fall by the wayside. You may not reach the goal. Or another possibility, people may die before they reach their spiritual destination, before they become fully enlightened in a spiritual sense. It happens. What do you do? Well, if you can give the answer, well, if you don't succeed, you are damned to hellfire. If you succeed, you are promised heaven. This is a simple answer, but Gita doesn't give that answer. Because according to Gita, according to yoga philosophy, life is not a linear progression. This life is not moving in a straight line, ending on a full stop. Death is not a full stop. Death is a semicolon or a comma. Maybe that also may not be there. It continues. So according to yoga and Vedanta, existence of human life, and also the cosmos, at the macro level, the entire cosmos, at the micro level, human life, moves in a cycle, not in a straight line. If we work hard, if we sincerely work hard, even if we can't do much, if you just meditate for half an hour in our life, or if you listen to one good lecture with serious, with total concentration. And if one spiritual thought registers itself in the mind, that itself can come to a rescue, if not in this life, in the next life. In other words, nothing is lost. The least effort has its benefits. That is the unique message of Gita. That is the subject of discussion today. So Arjuna puts his question, 37th verse of 6th chapter. Ayadi saddhayo pedo yoga chalida manasaha aprapya yoga samsiddhim kam gatim krishna gacchati. This is a simple question. Come, I mean, what is the fate of a person who has got concentration, sincerity, but has not fully succeeded in the practice of yoga, in spiritual, I mean, has not become fully spiritually enlightened. What is his fate? What will happen to him or her? In fact, this is the fundamental line of demarcation between the Abrahamic concept of human existence and the Vedantic and yogic concept of human life. Because in the early stage of Christianity, according to modern theologians, it took many of the ideas from Neoplatonism. And Neoplatonists, both Philo and Plotinus, as you call Plotinus, maybe some of you, got this idea from Greek mystery religions. There was interaction between Vedantic tradition of the East and the ancient Greece, right from the period of Thales, 7th century BC onwards. So there is a quotation from Plato, from Apology. He says, "Know of a certainty that no evil can happen to a good man either in life or in death." So you can find the echoes of the idea of rebirth and love karma in the works of Plato and also in the works of the Neoplatonists, both Philo and also Plotinus. Now, Krishna's answer is based on this principle. The answer is very simple. Of course, before we deal with Lord Krishna's answer, we can just go through Arjuna's description of his own problem, the doubt that he feels within you. Kachinno bhayavi brashtaka chinna bhimavanasyati apradishto mahabahu vimudho brahmana padhi. This is the simple question. The answer is this. The question is this. Arjuna says, what happens to a person who doesn't reach the ultimate goal of spiritual life in this life, in our effort? You find you come across many people. Sometimes they make sincere effort. And at the end, if you have one deviation, the total result is zero, then nobody will take to yoga. Why should you pray if God is such an uncompromising tyrant that a single deviation or an error on our part will cross the answer paper with red ink and everything is gone? So, Arjuna is actually asking this question. So he compares the possibility of a person being completely lost to a patch of dark cloud which may be moving in the air. If there is a strong wind blowing, the cloud may get broken. It may be distracted. It could get broken into pieces. It may get lost eventually. Like that, human life also will be totally lost if there is one error, one deviation in our spiritual life. That's a question which Arjuna asks, which is a very serious question in modern times. Yedanme samsyam Krishna chetu marhasi asheshataka tadanya samsyasi asya cheta nau hipapadyate. There is nobody else other than you who could solve this problem. That is Arjuna's question. Now the answer is more important. The answer is very simple. First, Krishna gives a very decisive, clear answer. Partha naiveka na mutra vinasastasya vidyade nahi kalyanakrit kasya durgadim tada gacchadi. The word is used, tada means child, disciple, son. These are the terms, you know. So Krishna says, whatever little you do, kalyanakrit means anybody who does a little, a small noble work. If you have helped a blind man to cross the streets, if you have helped somebody in trouble, not that you may go to a place of worship and pray there, perform some ceremonies, no. Kalyanakrit kaschid means anybody who does some little noble deed. Krishna doesn't insist on profession of a belief. That is a very important point. Unless you understand, unless you study comparative religion, you won't understand the greatness of this teaching. Krishna doesn't insist that God's existence is dependent upon your faith in his existence. That's why Swami Vivekananda, referring to this idea, says, even if you do not believe in God, you can be spiritual. So live your life in such a way that God will choose you, God will accept you, even if you do not accept him. So here Krishna says, anybody who does something good, that act of goodness may be in the form of prayer for half an hour in his whole life, one noble unselfish act of charity or philanthropy, one noble thought flashing in the mind, any of these can be interpreted as a noble deed. Deed could mean intellectual deed, volitional, emotional, or physical act. Anybody who does something noble, good, unselfish, that person is investing a huge amount in the spiritual bank so that he can draw his check in the next life. That's the idea behind. So whatever little we do, if we meditate for half an hour, for 10 minutes, the result of that good deed, the spiritual practice, will remain in our mind, in the spiritual bank, and you will be benefited in your future life, not necessarily in this life. So, that's why, na iha na amutra, neither in this world nor in the next world. That's the point. Amutra means in afterlife. That means life is not a straight line progression, it is in a cycle. So, even if a person practices a little spirituality for his own spiritual enlightenment, or does a noble deed, an act, for the good of others, a totally unselfish act, an unselfish thought, an idea that flashes in the mind, all these will have an effect. It will register, and a tendency, an impression is created in the internal organ. It's called antakarana in Sanskrit, in the mind, and it will follow him to his next life. So nobody should worry about hellfire or losing everything at the end. Whatever we do, that will be beneficial. So we are never late. It doesn't mean that we should have complacency. No. It is not an advocacy for complacency. Sri Krishna is not encouraging us to be complacent. The idea is this. There is no need, no room for disappointment. Anybody can practice any day, any time, can open a new leaf in his or her life, a new chapter. Then he says, Durgadim na gachai means he will never perish. Nothing evil, nothing bad will happen to him. Whatever little we do, we will be benefited by that noble and selfish act, meditation, prayer, or anything like that. And spiritual practice doesn't necessarily mean a ceremonial practice for our own spiritual progress. It could also mean any unselfish, noble act. Now, how does this mechanism work? This is a famous verse where Lord Krishna gives a great promise to mankind. Prapya punya kridan lokan ushitva shashvati samaha shuchinam srimadam gege yoga bhrashto bhijayate. There are two types of people. Now you find there are two types of people among those who try to practice, lead spiritual life. There are those who want money, status, the good things of life, comforts, and also practice some spiritual sadhanas, some spiritual practices. There are those, of course the number is very small, who do not care anything, don't care for physical comforts, material comforts. They don't care for anything worldly. They are completely focused on spiritual enlightenment. Look at a man like Buddha, for example. He gave up his kingdom, his comforts, his wife and children, and went and sat under a tree. Ihasene susyasudhume sariram, like that is a famous verse in Buddha Bidhu Ashugosha's history of Buddha. And he sat under a tree and didn't get up from there until he got enlightenment. Everyone cannot practice. This is not a prescription for the whole humanity. So, the majority of people belong to the latter category. They want to live a normal life. They want the good things of this world. Their desire for enjoyment has not come to an end. At the same time, they have also a sincere desire for spiritual progress. What happens to them? That's the first subject dealt with. Krishna says, as I said, they have some desire, some unfulfilled desire, some dreams which they want to fulfill. They will be born in such a family, in such a surrounding, in such a situation, where they will get enough scope to fulfill their unfulfilled desires and dreams, so that they will be able to go beyond that. People who struggle to make wealth in this life, plenty of money, and at the same time, try to practice some spiritual life. Next life, will be born in a family or in a situation where the parents will be full affluent, and they may get enough wealth to enjoy, but they will also have a strong desire for spiritual progress. So they will go beyond that stage, and gradually they will evolve to a higher spiritual state. Will they transcend the realm of worldly desires? That is, it's a very logical analysis of the continuity of human life. That's why if you go to schools, you find, if you just make a study, psychological study of, say, 100 students in a class, 100 students belong to 100 different levels of emotional, intellectual, psychological categories. They will have 100 different tendencies and impressions. So, because they have gone through different stages in the previous life and reached a particular stage, so they have to continue their journey from the state where they have reached in the previous life. This is the Vedantic interpretation of the continuity of human life. So Lord Krishna says, such people who have practiced spirituality to some extent, but at the same time have not fully accomplished their desire, not fully fulfilled their desires, they will be born in families which will be prosperous, which will give them ample scope for fulfilling their unfulfilled desires. At the same time, they will also inherit these spiritual tendencies because they have practiced spirituality in previous life. Now, and as for others, those who are advanced spiritual seekers, who have no desire for anything worldly, who have completely gone beyond, transcended all desires, what happens to them? They will be born in such families where naturally the parents and the surroundings will be conducive to the practice of pure spirituality, because they have no desire left anything else. So right from their birth, they will be obsessed with a strong desire for spiritual enlightenment. And so Krishna says they will be born in the families of yogis, that's what called. They will be born in the families of yogis. So I mean they will be born in certain social and domestic surroundings where the practice of yoga, the higher renunciation, becomes natural and easy for them. So, athava yogina meva kule bhavati dhimadam yadadhi durlabhadaram loke janma yadidrisam. Oh, they'll be born in the family of yogis, means the accomplished spiritual personalities, where they will be able to continue their spiritual journey without any obstacle, because they have no desire left, but still they have not achieved their goal in this life. This is, now how does this work? In the 43rd verse, Lord Krishna gives a rather psychological interpretation of how this mechanism actually works in human life. Tatratam buddhi samyogam labhate paurvadekhikam yatadecha tado bhuya samsiddhu kurinantana. Well, suppose we are walking in the street and we see a board, maybe an advertisement advertising some commercial events or anything related to worldly enjoyments. And we may also come across some billboards, maybe about some meditation classes or something related to spiritual practices. How do we feel like entering a meditation center and not other places? What is the criterion? What propels us towards spiritual life. What enables us to sit and listen to these ideas, which are certainly not very pleasant, except to those who are interested in this. You tell people, you go to the street and talk to people, you should practice yoga. Not Hatha yoga they may practice because that enables them to enjoy this world better. But you talk to people about a yoga that goes beyond enjoyment of this world. They won't be able to, psychologically they won't be able to withstand this onslaught. They will run away for their life. It happens. So even to be able to intellectually withstand the impact of spiritual ideas, we need a spiritual culture, which perhaps we may have inherited from previous life. So what happens? This body dies, and all these five senses of perception, five senses of action also perish with this body. But impressions created by activities involving mind and these senses of perception and senses of action, these impressions are retained in a mechanism which is called in Sanskrit antakarana. The main component of this internal system is mind, because mind retains memories, tendencies, impressions, we call samskaras, which are subtle, which make us, which propel us to move and do certain things in a given manner and to avoid certain other things. How do we explain this otherwise? So you find many of modern psychiatrists explain multiple personality on the basis of inherited conflicting tendencies and samskaras. So schizophrenia, which we call modern, ancient times, maybe, and split personality, multiple personality are sometimes explained, maybe not fully acceptable to modern scientists and psychiatrists, are explained in the light of inherited conflicting tendencies and impressions, mutually conflicting tendencies that we cannot explain logically in the light of experiences related to this life. So it comes from another source. So Lord Krishna says, Tatradam Buddhism Yogam. In the next life, a person in his next life is united with the intelligence, with the tendencies, with the impressions that he has acquired in this life. And with those inherited tendencies and impressions, he lives, and these tendencies and impressions constitute what we normally understand and call character. Not the external behavior, but the internal abstract behavior patterns are always influenced by certain tendencies and impressions that may have their origin not in this life, but sometime in the past. And these inherited tendencies and impressions make us behave in a particular manner, make us do things in a given manner. And they decide what we accept from this world, what they decide the way we receive ideas in our interaction with other human beings. In other words, when we read a scripture, what we understand from the scripture depends upon our character. Naturally, it's very obvious. And what is our character? This character is an abstract, subtle mechanism whose main component is a huge bag containing tendencies and impressions and samskaras coming from previous lives. So Lord Krishna says, if anybody tries to do something noble, practice a little spirituality in this life, he has to carry this bag of samskaras, impressions. Whether he likes it or not, he will have to carry this with him. There is no choice. With these samskaras, with this we are born again, and we continue our journey, we continue our spiritual life, helped by these samskaras. That's why he says, nothing will be lost, So Lord Krishna is nahi kalyana krit kaschit durgadim tadagachadi. Nobody who does something noble, either for his own spiritual good or for the good of others, they will not perish. The accumulated tendencies and impressions will always come to his or her rescue in the next life. So nothing is lost. We are never late. That's the message of the Lord in these verses. In the 44th verse he says, of course he is referring to the compelling force of these accumulated tendencies and impressions. It is something that makes us behave in a manner. You may have noticed there is always a conflict between what we want to do and what we would like to do. There are not many people in the world who would like to be good. Even the criminals in the prison, given a chance, they would certainly be law-abiding citizens. They wouldn't like to commit crimes, except the hardened criminals. There are very, very few. So why is there conflict between what we want to do, what we would like to do, and what we normally do? Why this conflict? If we have full control over our own mechanism, like the control that we have over a machine or a computer that we work with, then we would be able to do whatever we want to do. But when the real movement comes, there's a conflict. People want to tell truth all the time, but then when the moment comes, something within them forces them to tell untruths. So why is this conflict between intellect and mind? We live at the level of mind, emotions. What we are very much depends upon our mind. What we would like to be, what we would like to do depends upon our intellect. When we read books, we won't mind being a Buddha, if possible. Everyone tries to be great, good, noble, do good things, and become good people, good men and good women. There is nobody in the world who tell you, well, I want to be bad man. No. It's impossible. So there is at one point, at the intellect level, there is what we would like to be, what we would like to do. At the mental level, the emotional level, there is another personality, what we normally do in a given situation. So it's all because of the inherited tendencies and impressions that comes from previous life. That's why Lord Krishna in the 44th verse, Purvabhyasena tenaiva kriyadehi avashopisaha. Avasha means helpless. See, by the force of tendencies and impressions and samskaras and characteristics that we have inherited from previous lives, we are born with this and we behave and act, we are totally helpless. So what is the option here? What is the way out? The way out is very simple. Try to do good things, think good thoughts as much as possible. So instead of trying to avoid doing bad things, instead of trying to avoid going towards the east, you rather try to move towards the west, Sri Ramakrishna says in the Gospel. If you try to avoid moving towards the east, the best way to do is constantly keep moving to the west. So the best way to avoid accumulating undesirable tendencies and impressions is to keep on trying to accumulate positive, helpful tendencies and impressions. That's why he says, otherwise we will become helpless. So that's why Swami Vivekananda in one context said that we are good, we can't help being good. We are bad, we can't help being bad. But it should not lead us into thinking that, into thinking the philosophy of predeterminism. It will be totally against the spirit of the teachings of Gita. Gita is totally against predeterminism. Because predeterminism destroys everything. It becomes diehard fatalism, which is the antithesis of spirituality. We are our own masters. We can decide our destiny. So karma yoga doesn't mean that we are helpless tools, instruments in the hands of an almighty tyrant karma. No. Its real implication is, if we are what we are today because of what we did yesterday, then we can decide our tomorrow by improving our deeds today. If today is the result of yesterday, then tomorrow is the result of today. And today we have the freedom to do that. So there are two elements, Lord Krishna says. One element is the inherited element of character, human character. That's why he says, purvabhyasena tainaiva kriyadehi avashopis. Avasha means helpless. Because of previous practices, accumulated tendencies and impressions, we tend to do certain things in a certain manner. That's true. But at the same time, there is always the scope to sublimate, to purify these tendencies, these impressions by the practice of spirituality. That means that opens the doors and windows for everyone. That means karma is not a tyrant. We can work as masters and not as slaves of karma. In fact, that is what yoga is all about. So Lord Krishna says, we can improve our own character, our own accumulated tendencies and abstract thought currents and characteristics by the practice, by constant practice of spiritual sadhana. It need not necessarily be in the form of a ceremonial worship or anything. If any unselfish, noble thought, deed, act, an idea, if we sincerely believe and practice, that becomes a spiritual practice. And that will have a purifying effect on our samskaras. So I can give an illustration, then we will conclude. Then we will have 5 minutes interaction, if you want. Now, you think of a bag. The bag, see, our own mind, our own character, full of accumulated tendencies and impressions and samskaras, thought currents, natural tendencies. This is the bag that we carry, our own character. So it contains both good and also bad, desirable and also undesirable tendencies and impressions. Now, if we go on putting good thoughts, good deeds, good tendencies into the bag, what happens? The bag, its contents will have more of good deeds, more of positive tendencies and impressions, and less and less of its opposite, undesirable tendencies. Likewise, we must keep practicing some kind of spiritual sadhana. It could be in the form of meditation, contemplation, reading scriptures, listening to these ideas, or even sitting somewhere trying to think of great noble deeds of great noble personalities. All these amount to be spiritual practices, should be considered to be spiritual practices, because every thought leaves a mark in the system, and that enriches, purifies, sublimates, and it reinforces the positive tendencies we have already accumulated. And that will help us to move forward. That is the description. Now, before I conclude, I want to read this announcement. This is very important. There will be no class next Friday. May 23rd, because of our special program in Olima, which begins on 24th Saturday. So the next class will be on Friday, May the 30th at 7:30 p.m. here in this hall. Please remember, there will be no Friday class next Friday, May 23rd. And next class will be on Friday, May the 30th at 7:30 p.m. So thank you. Now we will have interaction if any of you are interested in discussing any topics either related to what I tried to explain today or in general any spiritual topics. You are most welcome. Focus on
pain. Oh,
that's an illustration.
You may be aware that some teachers in the Buddhist practice actually tell you, as a matter of mindfulness, that attention to the pain in a mindful way will help that disappear. What do you think of that?
I think their emphasis is different. If you concentrate with mindfulness, then your mind transcends that feeling of pain. Mind goes beyond it. In fact, this is also from yogic practice. Yogis could cure the diseases by concentrating on the particular point. You remember in Sri Ramakrishna's life, some of his disciples requested him, why don't you cure this cancer disease by concentrating? He could do that, but he didn't do that. But generally, spiritual personalities don't apply this spiritual practice for curing diseases or anything. But then in Buddhist tradition, the idea is if you focus on that, then mind gradually transcends that, goes beyond it. So if you focus with mindfulness, mind transcends that point of focus. Suppose you are undergoing some dental problem without local anesthesia, there is a pain. If you focus, if you practice a kind of indifference or trying to put the mind on that aspect, your mind won't feel that pain. And so Buddhism, this practice comes from a school of Buddhist philosophy known as Yogacara. Vijnanavad, it's called subjective idealism. They were practitioners of yoga. This mindfulness comes from the second school of idealism in Buddhist philosophy. It's called Yogacara Vijnanavada. The former one is Shunyavada. So, it is a practice of yoga, actually, mindfulness.
I think, as I recall, the instruction is to attend to the sensation and not the let go into thought and story. I think that, as you were talking, I think don't let it turn into a story of identifying the form as pain, but stay with the sensation of...
Yes, the idea is the pain should be looked upon as something that you witness and not identified with your own system. In fact, that is the real purpose of this focus. That is the Yogacara system, So, if you can dissociate yourself from the agency of the person who is suffering, then the sensation of pain will be reduced. See, fundamentally, it is a practice of witnessship. It's called sakshi. In Vedanta, it's called sakshi, means witnessship. Non-participant. You are witnessing a drama as a spectator, sitting on the front row, but not as a participant playing the drama. So, if you are undergoing this dental problem, which I referred to earlier, and now when you feel pain, and you look upon yourself, the person who is undergoing, suffering the pain, as somebody other than your true self. The person who feels the pain becomes an object, and your real identity, your real entity, your personality is seeing that. So there is a dissociation, the witness and object that you are witnessing. So this dissociation helps you to transcend pain by concentration. It comes from a Yogacara philosophy, Vasubandhu, Dignaga, and other Buddhist philosophers who lived in the 3rd and 4th century AD. Yoga, their name is called Yogacara. They practice the principle of yoga.
You said about intellect and mind. If you want to do something, but you are not. So as you work out your past impressions, then you get more control over what you can do.
Well, if you could concentrate on some of the good natural tendencies, naturally good tendencies that you feel you have within you, and if you focus on that, then you can overcome some of the influence of negative tendencies. So in fact, we have, our character contains both. We can focus on the positive ones, then the influence of negative ones will be reduced. They'll vanish. They won't remain. Once the positive tendencies increase in intensity and influence, negative ones will be practically neutralized. Their impact and influence will be neutralized. That's why when you come in contact with great spiritual personalities, when you read great books, suddenly you feel drawn towards them. And some of the undesirable tendencies may slowly decrease and eventually vanish. It happens. That is called Mahapurusha Samsara. Yes. So we need this. Oh, yes.
When you were talking about inherited tendencies, you mentioned that if it has come from this life, it's associated with a name and form.
Oh yes, see, there are any number of books, case studies of rebirth and reincarnation, which you may or may not accept, but still, if you observe the common life experiences, you find in our own life, we carefully observe our own, analyze our own character, we feel we can find there are some inherited strong attitudes and behavior patterns that we have brought with, that already exist within us. Some of them could be traced to childhood experiences, the upbringing, the education, the people among whom you have lived. Genetic factors may also have a role in this. But there are some factors which cannot be explained in the light of domestic environment, the school you may have studied, or in terms of genetic heredity. So, they are much subtler, much more forceful. They are the main driving forces. That's why when those tendencies suddenly come to the surface, all other ones are subsided. That's why people, I can see, very often you find, a great saint in India who went to Benares at the age of 11 or 12 year old. He was a servant of a rich man. Went to Ganga to take bath in the holy river, and he was passing through the streets and saw an ashram or a temple and entered, and he completely forgot what he was, what for he had come there, and he reappeared only after 30 years. He did tapasya. He's a great man who lived up to 94th year. He passed away long back. So there are many such events in the lives of saints and sages. Or think of St. Francis of Assisi. There will be many knights, warriors, but all of them didn't undergo that kind of transformation. That experience, there was a sudden change in him. But All people in identical circumstances may not have identical experiences, the same impact. So that's because of some strong inherited characteristics that cannot be explained in terms of genetics, heredity, or acquired tendencies. So we call inherited tendencies. Inherited not from genetic factors, but from other sources. Right. If genetics is a deciding factor, then 10 children of the same parent should be identical. Like, the matchboxes in the same factory will be identical in size and shape. And all that. Machines and cars are identical when they come from the factory, assembly lines. But human beings are not like that. If we are identical, then we should be able to act and behave exactly as we decide. But we can't do that. We can never be sure that tomorrow morning we will act exactly as we are planning today. We may, but there is no certainty. See, we can be sure as to how the computer is going to work, the machine, because you program an artificial intelligence into it. But we can't be sure about our own mind, how it is going to function next moment. Which means there is something other than the empirical, something trans-empirical, as they call it. So thank you. So we'll continue this discussion maybe on Friday, May the 30th, at the same time. Thank you. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti.